is Stephen Yablon, who brings a completely different perspective to this session and perhaps to the whole APHA conference, because he's an architect and he's going to talk about from that perspective. Stephen established a Stephen Yablon Architects in New York City in 1995 to create innovative contemporary architecture, urban design, and interiors that express the unique qualities of place and client identity. His portfolio includes award-winning community centers, healthcare, academic and recreational facilities, visual and performing arts centers, workplaces, urban design, and residential commissions. Since 2005, Stephen's firm has participated in Mayor Bloomberg's Innovative Design Excellence Initiative. Through that program for new civic projects in New York City, his firm has assisted the NYC Department of Health in transforming their historic New Deal era public community health centers in medically underserved neighborhoods into open and welcoming facilities that encourage use of free STD screening, education, and treatment services. These new clinics have won numerous National Design Excellence Awards and been published extensively.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I do have some public health street cred. My co-presenter has an MPH, so my co-writer. So, let's see. So what we're going to talk about here is slightly different from probably anything else at this conference, which is more how what we've been exploring with the Department of Health and the New York City Department of Design and Construction is how the actual architectural design of STD clinics can encourage people to use them and to seek more testing, treatment, and counseling, specifically in medically underserved urban communities. As a background, in 2004, New York City, under Mayor Bloomberg, created its first ever comprehensive healthcare public plan for the entire city. And one of its prime goals was to reduce the spread of HIV in the city of New York. They decided to do this in some of their historic public health facilities. And one of the things that I'm going to cover in this talk is the challenges of actually converting these public health facilities into more welcoming and state-of-the-art STD clinics. But first, it's important to know a little bit about the history of these clinics, which are quite interesting. In the early part of the 20th century in New York City, due to conditions including overcrowding, tenement living conditions, and lack of access to health care caused by massive unemployment caused later on by the Great Depression, there were pretty intense problems in New York City in public health, as many of you might know, including high incidences of communicable diseases, high infant maternal mortality, and high incidences of venereal diseases. In 1929, the city of New York decided that the best way to combat this was to do this in a decentralized method. So they divided the city into 30 health districts, each which served 200,000 people. Each one of these districts, and this is actually a booklet from the time explaining what these districts would do, each one of these districts would address the unique health problems of each neighborhood, which were really related to which immigrant groups lived in that neighborhood, the actual conditions in that specific neighborhood. These clinics would monitor conditions, identify problems, provide health education and screening, and coordinate care delivery. And what's fascinating is that they really, underneath these districts, were a wide group of people, including physicians, district health workers, local labor unions, parents, teachers, social welfare agencies. But what's amazing is that they were all housed in a central building, in the central healthcare clinic, which was a very unique problem and very revolutionary at the time. The health center building was defined at the time as a neighborhood headquarters from which all health and related social services are administered for a specific district. And it would visualize to this local citizens the services of the Department of Health and serve as an educational medium for public health. They provided a wide range of services from these public health clinics: administrative services, health education, medical and dental services, preventable disease control, and even inspection of facilities like inspections of restaurants and the sort. Now, very few of these facilities got built in the early 30s because of the Depression, but under the WPA, Mayor LaGuardia, a great champion of public health and social welfare, was able to get funds from the WPA to build 14 of these centers throughout the city of New York. And here are some of them, how they looked. And you can see they hired some of the most eminent architects of the time to really, through the design, communicate that the care of New York City citizens was very important to the city of New York. And they were actually designed on the level of branch libraries, train stations. They had that level of architects doing these things. This is a typical plan of one of the clinics. You can see there were actually four clinics on one floor, which included maternal and infant welfare, a dental clinic, a venereal disease clinic, and a tuberculosis clinic. And these are some scenes from the use of these buildings at the time, including venereal disease clinic, immunization labs, infant health, and particular care to specific immigrants. And these are a group of gypsies here. And as I said, education, in this case, an oral hygiene room where they would teach kids how to take care of their teeth. Through the 50s and the 70s, these clinics, the use of them changed as the public health needs changed. Specifically added was mass rapid immunization programs and chronic disease prevention. This is a diphtheria immunization program at one of the clinics. Polio. Continued emphasis on venereal disease. TB. I love this slide. And as you know, in the 1980s, with the advent of HIV and AIDS, they became the central place for testing and treatment for AIDS, screening to education and treatment. However, by this time, these clinics had fallen into great disrepair, and it had a lot of very unsympathetic renovations done to them, and had really become alienating places and did not encourage people to use them. One of the goals under the mayor's program, as I mentioned, was to stop the spread of HIV and other sexually transmitted infections. But because of the condition of these clinics, it was decided that the best way to continue treating this was to use these clinics because they were in the communities where there was the most incident of HIV/AIDS. However, because they were so intimidating, they felt that they could not really get people to come into these places. Under the Design Excellence Program, we were hired, our firm, to start undertaking the renovation of some of these facilities and to create a program for future renovations of all the facilities. When working with the Department of Health, we determined some criteria and some goals. We wanted them to provide a welcoming, respectful, and reassuring patient experience. The primary goal was to reduce anxiety through the actual architectural planning, use of materials, and lighting. Instead of just signage, we wanted the architecture itself to enhance patient orientation. A lack of orientation would really cause a high degree of anxiety in these places. And also to make the visit very efficient. Most importantly, to instill a sense of ownership in these facilities, to make it feel like it was their community's facilities, by reducing defensive design and reflecting community in place. To bring the high quality of design throughout the facility, not just the reception area. And to employ highly maintainable materials so that these facilities lasted for a long time and did not use up a lot of the maintenance and operational budgets of the Department of Health. Some of the challenges that we dealt with, and this is a diagram of a plan, as you saw before, is that these buildings were designed for very small clinics. And they were subdivided by stairs, elevators, main lobbies. The new clinics were double and triple the size of these because of the amount of people coming in to use the STD facilities. Also, the process of treating STD was much more complicated than it used to be to treat venereal diseases. And in the new clinic, you had intake, you had triage, you had express testing of patients, you had the exam in clinical areas, and then you had extensive counseling services afterwards after they were examined. This is a cross-sectional diagram through these buildings, where the original buildings were basically designed for no heating, no ventilation at all. I mean, they just have windows. They weren't really designed for modern ventilation systems. So the challenge of fitting modern-day ventilations was very difficult with the low floor-to-floor heights in these buildings. What I'll talk about is two of the facilities, one of which is built and one of which is about to be built, one in central Harlem and the other one in Chelsea. And these are what the original design of the buildings look like. The Central Harlem facility is a landmark McKim, Mead & White building in New York City. As you can see, the interiors before we started were pretty alienating. Did not look welcoming at all. It kind of epitomized public health clinics in the 1950s. Again, we started with a space that was very subdivided by lobbies and stairs and elevators, and try to make a unified STD clinic was going to be difficult. With its three major parts and patients going back and forth to these parts and kind of getting lost potentially, and not, they don't really, one thing that's important to notice is that they don't have nurses escorting the patients throughout these facilities. They don't have the staff to allow to do that. The way this was solved in this one was to put the counseling and intake on one side and the clinical on the other, but then use the waiting and triage areas, this long space linking the two, along the windows in the back with a lot of natural light. And this is what the plan of this facility ended up looking like. As you can see, upon entry, it's quite different than it used to look like. Because of then not that much natural light in the middle, we simulated a skylight in the entry, and it's very warm materials throughout, but very durable. And the combination of kind of high-tech and warm materials throughout was used to connote a reassurance that they're getting the highest level of care, but also very personalized, warm attention. When you enter, the triage is in a very private space, but also very light-filled. The actual notion of reassuring and kind of getting the latest care, but also warm, is actually treated throughout the space three-dimensionally in this series of interlocking L's of high-tech materials and warm materials that go throughout the entire space. And as you can see right here, the high-tech materials are wrapping in the ceiling and coming down one wall, and the warm materials are in the floor and coming up the other side. By bringing these throughout the space, provides a sense of orientation. On the right-hand wall right there is a luminous wall that actually hides a view of a service court. But what weds it to its local community is a resinous wall that's embedded in there, beadwork made by survivors of AIDS in Africa. And these are the corridors. Again, the high-level design goes throughout the entire space, integrating mechanical in a discrete way that allows us to have very high ceilings throughout the corridors and not your typical drop ceilings. A sub-waiting area. This is a little waiting area where you would wait for your blood test results. Exam rooms, lockers for staff, and a counseling room. The high level of detail given to this space, we believe, has had caused, in the first couple of years that it's been open, almost a 10 to 15% increase in patient visits. And I think that's only the beginning, is the word of this facility gets out to the community. The Chelsea Health Clinic is a much larger project. This is a full gut renovation of a 1930s New Era, New Deal building. One of its unique characteristics is that it's in a public park. As you can see, it's been fallen under disrepair. It feels very defensive. There was guards on the lower windows, a huge amount of mechanical equipment on the roof that's very imposing looking. The interior is about as defensive as you can get. I mean, you walk in and you feel like you're walking into a prison guard station here. So the message to the community is that you're something to be defended against, and we wanted to get rid of that. Our primary way of wedding this to the community and making it welcoming was to take advantage of its location in a public park by creating more views to the park through all the waiting areas and circulation and use of materials. This is the main floor where you can see that the waiting areas are all located on the park with views to the park. On the right is the intake, on the left is the express screening where people can get very quickly tested for AIDS. There are other clinics in the building also, including a general health clinic. And the main clinical floor is the second floor, with its waiting room and circulation along the park. In terms of materials and forms, the park is literally brought inside the building through curved, natural-shaped ceilings and also use of an innovative tile system. So the general impression of this, and this is about to start construction in about 5 months from now, is what we wanted to create was sort of a high-tech park pavilion with natural finishes on the floors and ceilings. And on the left is a tile pattern that mimics the sycamore trees in the park, which also acts as an orientation device as patients are going through. They see that wall and they always know where they are as they're going through their testing and evaluation. This aesthetic is carried throughout the building, and including part of the city's initiative is to create something called the Fit City Initiative, which is to actually encourage people to use stairs instead of elevators so that they get fitter. And so in this facility, we created a very open, light-filled stair to encourage people to use this. The aesthetic and whole treatment of care is carried through all the way into the exam rooms and the counseling rooms. On the exterior of the building, it's a landmark quality building, so you can't do a whole lot of modification to it, but we wanted to screen the really imposing mechanical equipment on the top and remove all the window guards and open up the windows, but we replaced it with security glass so that would not suffer any vandalism. And did the same thing to all the other sides of the building, too, to basically create a more welcoming, friendlier appearance to the community. As a result of this work, we were commissioned by the Department of Health to create the design guidelines for all future ambulatory care clinics for the City of New York. And what that involves is creating a very streamlined method for future clinics to be designed, but also assuring the same level of care for all clinics throughout the city. Okay, thank you. Including communicating the correct patient flow, the typical design for all exam rooms, and proper materials to be used throughout. What were some of the lessons learned going forward? When you do public projects, I'm sure in any city, but particularly in New York City, they take a long time to be built. During that time, priorities change, entire departments change, people, staff leave who we were working with. It's very important to design more flexibility into these facilities to allow that change to happen. We think that one of the problems in getting more people to use this and using historic buildings is that we cannot modify the exterior of the buildings very much. So it's very difficult for that community to know that something new has actually happened there and that it is a friendlier place. That's a difficulty. Also, we are often in the position of responding to the Department of Health's method of delivering care, which sometimes could be more complicated than it needs to be. We think in the future it would be good for us to work very closely with them to help them redesign that process in some way, because that has a direct impact on how people move through the space. And lastly, we would suggest that it's very important when designing these facilities to provide a post-occupancy review so that you actually know how some of these things that we've put into place actually work, or if they work. But in the end, it's our belief, and it's been borne out anecdotally so far, that creating these spaces is very welcoming, warm, non-defensive, really has a huge impact in people wanting to come to them, feeling it's like it's their place to use, to seek more testing and treatment and counseling for HIV-STD. Thank you.
Thank you. Stephen can take one or two questions, and then we open the floor for all the presenters. Questions for everybody. Yes,
sure.
Please.
Sure.
With regards to when you get the floor plan for counseling and case management and clinical clinic, were those wall-off areas, or did you have open and movable areas on those offices as well?
Those are closed offices. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're closed offices. A high degree was put on patient privacy throughout. That was a very important thing before. Even those glass enclosed triage rooms, I think the previous ones were you just sat behind a desk so that everybody could see what you were talking about, and that really added to people feeling anxious to coming into this place.
Question. I know that in terms of people getting tested, there have been reports about people reluctant to access testing because they fear being identified by people in their community.
Correct.
Was that part of the planning in terms of the designs of these clinics?
Yes. That was actually talked about a great deal. Actually, in that picture right there on that screen, the waiting rooms actually double as education spaces. So when you come in there, you see a video, and they educate people while they're waiting. But also on the top of the screen is a number that comes up telling you when you're identified as a number. Your name is not called, which was a whole system that we worked out with them, and there's no even public address system, actually. Your just number comes up, and it says go to room 502. So there's no way that somebody would know that your name was being called and told to go there. You're absolutely right. That's actually one of the biggest problems. Yes. Sorry.
Okay.
Pictures are always fun. Huh?
What country design process was in terms of incorporating feedback from stakeholders so that how did you know that this was going to be acceptable to the client?
Uh-huh.
And then I have a question. I wanted to know about the community involvement.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to add to that. Were the staff involved?
Heavily. Heavily, yeah. I mean, the patients weren't involved, but the way it still works on a district model, and that our clients were actually quite complex. I mean, our clients were the commissioner, the commissioner for STD, the commissioner of STD facilities, and all the various other clinics. So we had to meet with all of these people and work with them, but then also the people that ran the specific healthcare clinics. Those were our real users. And then within that, the people that worked that used the various departments. And we work with the physicians also in the various departments here also. So when you're working with something like this, it's a balance because you've got, you know, you've got citywide priorities and citywide standards, and then you've got the peculiarities of the community, which sometimes is in conflict with what the city wants. So it was a lot of back and forth, going back and forth to get the okay on all that. But it went pretty smoothly. It's just a very long process.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think what's unique about this is bringing high level design that you would see in a museum or something almost, and bringing it to underserved communities, which we've done not only here. We've done it in community centers in the South Bronx. And the response to this, these haven't been opening for that long, so we don't have a lot of response to this yet. But I can tell you in the community centers we've done in the South Bronx, the reaction of ownership and the increased use, because they don't feel like it's something that's being defended against them, and they feel like it's something they're very proud of, that they feel like they were almost given a fancy car, which is... They appreciate it. They use it more, and they brag about it. It really has a tremendous effect on use. So,
sorry.
No, I
thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Now the floor is open to questions to all the presenters. If you have any questions, please feel free to ask. Yes, please.
Yeah, I think it's so one of the things I didn't talk about is that the university where I was at, while still an evangelical Christian community, is not one of the most conservative ones. There are way more conservative Christian universities in Nigeria, and so they tend to be a little bit more on the liberal edge of conservative Christianity. And the bishop of the church and the president of the university, his wife is an American woman, a white American woman who happens to be my friend, and so while she is an evangelical Pentecostal missionary woman, she has a very open-minded view. And so throughout the process, there was this kind of struggle between, we want to do what's best for our students, but we also can't disobey what our church doctrine has. And so I don't think that they have a clear idea of what it is. They know that abortions go on, even though they're both legal in Nigeria and also against church doctrine, but they're still concerned, not only just because it's to them morally unacceptable, but also because women are getting injured and hurt and possibly dying. And so they have this strange space of, you know, we can put aside some of the moral repercussions to deal with the primary health of these students. And they do have HIV programs that are abstinence-based, and they like to focus on that, but they're also not stupid, and they know that they might have to talk about condoms, and they know that these happen, and so they have to figure out a way of pushing the envelope, but at the same time not going too far to make it seem like they're just a free-for-all and it's okay if you disobey God. And so there is this weird space that they are continuing to navigate, and so I know that they'll integrate the results into their programming for students, because they do have a very active student services center where they integrate all of these kind of messages into their weekly chapel services. They have student study groups every week. So I don't think that there would be anything necessarily drastically negative that would come out of it, but it's hard to say exactly what they're going to do with this information.
Will you have a role in continuing with program development?
Yeah, we have a very close relationship between me and my friends, because we're also friends in terms of also research partners. They did give me a lot of autonomy as to what I was able to do. They did have to say, you know, at some point here is a line we can't cross. But they were very open to negotiating on different kinds of things, and they want to keep me involved, and we have contact all the time, and they're always asking me, how are things coming? You know, what's coming out? And I've helped them with a lot of different projects just on the side, because I am very involved with community-based work.
I also have a question for Lindsay.
Okay, after her. Yeah, please go ahead. Yeah. You won't come here.
Yes, Indian Health Service is working towards universal testing, and so some of them are converting over from just prenatal testing to universal testing, so that's occurring in some of the communities. And if Lois can speak a little bit about that for hers, if you'd like to talk to her also. But as far as positive cases, it really depends on the community. Some of them did see positives. Which also link them to different resources and access to care for counseling and things like that. Currently, I do have a grantee, and in that particular community, it's 100% from last year in terms of positives.
Do you have a measure of religiosity in your client survey?
I don't have a big, because the survey was so large already, I didn't have a huge religiosity. I do ask them what their religious background is, how religious do they feel that they are, how spiritual they feel that they are. So I do have those measures in there. And it was kind of all over the place. There wasn't a clear, consistent pattern. Almost 90% of them identified as some sort of Christianity, majority Pentecostal, but there were some Catholics, Jehovah's Witnesses, and other people who attended, but there weren't any Muslims at their school or Hindus or Buddhists or any thing. So it was primarily, we did have a sizable number of agnostic identified participants, which I thought was interesting. And then the in terms of how religious to how spiritual went from very low to very high.
That measure, did you look at the association with any of the attitudes?
I haven't done that yet because I've just have started the data analysis, so I think that will be an interesting to look at.
Yeah. Yes, please.
I have a couple of questions about your findings and your measures. A question that was interesting to me was that you said that community participation was associated with more resignation to serve conversion. Yeah, that surprised me because we sort of have this sort of idea that, you know, positive community involvement leads to positive health outcomes, and I know we're also finding in some places in LGBT, although that's not necessarily the case, but did you?
Well, you have to remember also that the data set was from between 1996 and 1998, so
right.
The community was in a much different place then than now. I think at the time, I don't think there was the idea of retrovirals were starting being used, but they haven't really reached the critical mass that we see it now in terms of its impact on the community. So I think that's pretty much the reason why that relationship is there.
Okay, that makes sense. Do you mind having a couple of questions?
Good.
I was wondering about, you also mentioned that being out at was associated with less alienation, but I wasn't sure if you were being out of the HIV positive or out as gay.
Out as gay.
Okay, was associated with less alienation. And then, was the alienation experiencing homophobic harassment and violence associated with greater alienation? Is that sort of the alienation as a gay person or as a person?
About alienation as an HIV positive person.
As an HIV positive person. So I thought that was interesting too. I mean, obviously, you know, there's this sort of connection between
I have a question for Yvonne. So if any of these any of the people tested there are diagnosed as HIV positive, how are they linked to care and what is done to retain them in care?
I have a soft voice, so When they're linked to care, it really depends on the system and the health system that they're in. If it's Indian Health Service, sometimes they have a case manager, but they also have community organizations. And so sometimes the trouble is that sometimes the case manager has to travel 16 to 20 hours to get to a person. So really adherence is a big barrier. It's a big issue. And so now we're thinking of other things and strategizing with Indian Health Service and some of the other local community-based organizations to keep people in care more. So that it is a big issue.
No, it is. I was wondering.
I also had a question for Emilia. You mentioned that people who have social support had fewer partners.
With a specific kind of sexual activity, yes. They had fewer...
Being receptors of anal...
Receptors, anal sex without a condom.
Yeah. I was wondering if you had a chance to look at the types of relationships also. Is it like long-term relationship or just casual partners? Because if it is casual partners, it could also lead to more partners.
Right. For that measure, I did not differentiate between primary or secondary partners. It was just the number of men that they reported. Uh-huh. And it could be, you know, people with, they have a significant emotional connection with. They could be people that they have a very casual relationship with. I did not differentiate between that.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's what I was wondering. Any other questions?
For Stephen, just real quickly. Those guidelines, are they available on the web? The guidelines for, I'm not really sure.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a property of the New York City Department of Health.
Okay.
Probably available.
Yeah. Probably available, I'm not sure.
I mean, if you want more information about it, we can give you more contact information.
Okay. Thank you.
I have one question for Yvonne. Could you... I found your talk fascinating, and I was curious to hear a little more detail about how the tribal leadership deals with the discussion and changing attitudes about addressing HIV, and how hard is that? How hard is it?
So each community, each nation is different, and so the way that somebody like a public health specialist would approach them is going to be different. Some of them have tribal councils, so you come into a setting kind of like this and you have a chance to talk about the public health problem in which it might be testing, and say you want to implement more testing or start testing in the community, then that's the chance you have, and they vote on it. So sometimes it takes 3-6 a year, you know, month after month working with them. They have questions for you. You try to answer them as best as possible, keeping everything confidential, of course, because some of the issue as well is where they kind of want to know who in the community has what, and that also will bring a lot of stigmatized communities and people in the community to have stigmatization. So once that something is passed by the tribal council, from that point it's accepted, but it really depends on how long it takes to get accepted. So it really does take a lot of education. And so once leadership is behind the action, a lot of different things can occur. Some of them actually go out and, you know, talk, or they appear at different events, or, you know, something in the paper gets written. You know, it really depends. But a lot of them take different actions. Some of them become advocates, too. So a lot of good can come from the leadership actually taking a stand for it. Hope I answered that well.
It's almost 10. Any quick questions before we close the session? No. I would like to thank all the presenters on behalf of the HIV/AIDS section and APHA, and thank you all for coming at 8:30 in the morning. Really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.